How do we interpret the Old Testament? Well, first of all, I'm a Christian, and I want a Christian understanding of the Old Testament. You can't just study the culture and study the language and say, well, I'm coming up with my own interpretation. What makes your interpretation a Christian interpretation? What about a Jewish person who knows the ancient culture and knows the languages? Are they going to come up with a Christian interpretation? What makes your interpretation a Christian interpretation? Well, what does it mean to be a Christian? Very simply, a Christian is a follower of Jesus Christ. So, what that means is Jesus is Lord. If you're going to have a Christian interpretation of the Old Testament, you have to listen to Jesus and the apostles interpret the Old Testament. If you come up with an interpretation of the Old Testament that's different from Jesus and the apostles, it's not a Christian interpretation, whatever it is. So I believe my training is in the ancient Near East. Believe it or not, I'm not trained as a theologian, and I don't have a theological degree. My degree is from the University of Toronto in ancient Near Eastern studies. So I spent 19 years studying the archaeology, history, and languages of the ancient Near East. But I'm going to begin by reading from Revelation 21, because this is the only place in the New Testament where the apostles interpret Ezekiel 47 and 48. Now, I don't know if you've noticed this, but Hebrew literature is highly repetitive. So when a Hebrew person opens his mouth, the first thing you know is they're going to repeat themselves. And in verses 1 to 8, he describes the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. And then in verses 9 to 25, he does the same thing all over again. I'm just going to read that part. Revelation 21, 9. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. That's exactly Ezekiel 40, verse 1. And showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. That's right out of Ezekiel 47 and 48. On the east three gates, on the north three gates, on the south three gates, and on the west three gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. That part isn't in Ezekiel. Because, of course, that's the New Testament. And the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod, so did the man in Ezekiel 40 to 48. This measuring rod is of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city lies four square. The length is the same as its width. And he measured the city with his rod, 12,000 stadia. Its length and its width and its height are equal. Did you notice that? At first he says it's a square. Now he's telling you that it's a cube. He measured its wall, 144 cubits, by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement. The wall was built of jasper while the city was pure gold. But it says like clear glass. So obviously, it's wonderful, but it's beyond what we know. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysopras, the 11th jacinth, the 12th amethyst, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl. Wonder what the size of the oysters were like. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. The city has no need of the sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day. There will be no night there. So I want to give you a brief overview of Ezekiel. Hopefully, if I give you a big picture, you will be able to read the book for yourself and begin to understand it. For a long time, the book of Ezekiel completely mystified me, although I grew up in a Christian environment with a strong teaching tradition. We sang songs in Sunday school about Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel a-turnin', way in the middle of the air, but what did it all mean? And what relevance did it have for us today? After 15 years of faithful attendance at church services, I finally heard my first sermon on Ezekiel, Ezekiel 1, and it only added to the fog and mist in my thinking, rather than helping to clear them away. The book opens by introducing the reader to Ezekiel, a priest, living among the exiles from Judah in Babylon, who is given a vision of the glory of the Lord. In an awesome thunderhead cloud, surrounded by bright light and punctuated by flashes of lightning, he sees a bizarre vehicle. Above a platform is a sapphire throne, held by a human figure like glowing metal from the waist up and fiery from the waist down. Under the platform are four strange guardian creatures, each of them having four faces and four wings. On the ground beside each creature are four sets of intersecting wheels that can make the throne move in any direction. Movies produced during the last, 20 years by Marvel have nothing on Ezekiel's vision. Ezekiel is called by God as a sentry to warn the people of approaching judgment. He is addressed as Son of Man to emphasize that he belongs to the class of human beings characterized by weakness and requiring the breath and spirit of God for empowerment. Where does Ezekiel fit in the larger story? This strange vision, and indeed the book as a whole, can only be understood by placing Ezekiel's work within the larger story of Scripture. When God created the heavens and the earth, an entire paragraph is devoted to the description of making humans in the image of God. Mankind, both men and women together, are created so that their very being and existence entails a covenant relationship with God on the one hand and with the creation as a whole on the other. The former can be encapsulated by the notion of divine sonship and the latter by the concept of servant kingship. So we started out as sons and daughters of God and as servant kings to the whole world. While the term covenant is not actually used in Genesis 1 and 2, the relationship is nonetheless of the same nature and order as all covenant relationships described later in Scripture. It entails committed devotion and loyalty in a relationship characterized by faithfulness and loyal love. On the first page of Scripture, then we see its central theme, kingdom through covenant. I didn't choose this as the title of my book. It came from the Bible. God intends to establish his rule in the world by means of a loving covenant relationship, a relationship of love, of loyalty, of faith, of trust, of obedience. Obedient sonship would result in a rule by humans that would represent the rule of God, especially in the manner and way that God intended.
The bond in Eden, however, was violated by Adam's distrust of the Word of God and disobedience of the express will of God. At every level in the created order, chaos, discord, and death resulted. The destructive path chosen by the first humans led to increasing corruption until divine intervention was required. God used a flood to judge the entire human race and afterwards made a new beginning with Noah and his family. Noah is presented in the biblical story as a new Adam. He is given Adam's commission or mandate. Eventually, however, at Babel, the family of Noah ended up in the same chaos and corruption as the family of the first Adam. So God made a new start with another man called Abram. Abraham and his family called Israel is another Adam who will be God's true humanity. Through the Mosaic covenant formalized between God and Israel at Sinai, God called Israel to display to the rest of the world within its covenant community the kind of relationships first to God and then to one another that God intended originally for all of humanity. In fact, through Abraham's family, God plans to bring blessing to all the nations of the world. In this way, through the family of Abraham, through Israel, his last Adam, he will bring about a resolution of the sin and death caused by the first Adam. At the heart of establishing God's kingship in the world is worship. That's what we came here to do today. This is indicated by Genesis 2, which depicts Adam and Eve placed in a garden sanctuary. Only as they spend time in the presence of God will they be equipped to implement his rule in the world in the way that God himself would relate to his creation. So how is Adam to rule the world? To get his iPhone out and start making a list of all the things that he should do to subdue the earth? No, God says, I want you to hang out with me. Spend time in my presence. The more time you hang out with me, you'll begin to think the way I think. You'll be able to talk the way I talk. You'll act the way I act. And when you go out into the world, you will really represent me. So that's what we're doing. That's why we come to church on Sunday morning. Israel inherited the Adamic role of son of God at the Exodus. So at the Exodus, God says, Israel is my son. My firstborn son, let my son go that he may serve me. The word serve means to worship. The priority of worship becomes evident right away with the instructions to build the tabernacle. When the construction of this portable tent for worship was complete, a bright cloud symbolic of the divine presence settled on the tent to show that the Creator God was dwelling in the midst of his people as king. So at the heart of Israel's worship, there was this building with an outer room and an inner room, and inside the inner room was a little box, and that box represented the footstool for his invisible throne. And God is invisible, and his throne is invisible, and he sits above the Ark of the Covenant. This is where prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel fit into the story. The people had repeatedly violated the terms of the Mosaic covenant. Love of God and love of one's neighbor had been replaced by love of other gods and corruption of social justice in every way. As a result, Israel's worship had become hollow and hypocritical. Jeremiah is the first of the major prophets in the Hebrew canon. So in the Hebrew Bible, there are books are arranged differently. And the prophets are Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Isaiah. In Jeremiah 7 to 10, we have his famous temple sermon. Jeremiah went down to the temple and he said, "Do not trust in deceptive words and say, 'This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord.'" When you repeat something three times, it's the most emphatic way of saying something. This only happens four times in the Hebrew Bible. And you already know one other place, Isaiah 6, holy, holy, holy. One of the other ones is ruin, ruin, ruin. So that's a dire message. This threefold repetition is the strongest form of emphasis possible. Jeremiah is saying you can't live as you please and then treat the temple like a good luck charm or a rabbit's foot. You can't sort of have a cross hanging around your neck and then go and live however you want. The people thought they would always be protected as long as God was dwelling among them. Jeremiah's message was that covenant violation meant that God would be true to his threats and bring upon his people the curse of exile. So when they made the covenant, there were blessings and curses. I don't know when you last read Deuteronomy 28, but there's 15 verses of blessings and 45 verses of curses. And sooner or later, God has to be true to his word. Have you ever gone to a grocery store and you see a mom with a bratty child in tow, and you hear them say for the 10th time, "If you do that again, I'll..." And you say, "Why don't you just step up to the plate and be true to your words?" Well, eventually God steps up to the plate and he's true to his threats, okay? And the final curse is, "I'm going to kick you out of the land." Exile. Most importantly, he could no longer live among them as their behavior and lifestyle contradicted his own character as expressed in the Torah. Ezekiel carries the temple sermon of Jeremiah one step further. The opening vision shows the bright cloud, the glory of the Lord in motion, and the divine throne has wheels. Why does God's throne have wheels? Because he's getting ready to move out. God is surrounded by social injustice and idolatry, and the temple has lost its five-star hotel status. It's now a zero-star hotel, and God can't live there anymore. The same thing happened when Eli's sons were practicing immorality in the temple. God said, "I'm going to go to stay in the temple of the Philistines because that's at least better than what I've got here in Israel." This message must have come as an awful shock to the people of Judah. In Ezekiel 11-8, the opening vision is developed further. So he sees the same thing, and the glory cloud actually begins to move. It goes to the eastern gate, and it's starting to leave. Finally, the glory of God departs from the city of God. I express it in these terms to show that the city of God can no longer be the city of God when God is no longer there. A brief consideration of the shape and structure of Ezekiel's book shows the development and resolution of this problem. So unfortunately, we don't have this outline on the screen here, but I can go through it with you. In chapters 1 to 3, we have the opening vision and the call of Ezekiel. In chapters 3 to 7, we see Ezekiel's role and his message. Then in chapters 8 to 11, we see another vision of the glory of the Lord, and the glory of the Lord leaves the temple. Fourthly, in chapters 12 to 24, the exile is symbolized. So the ancient prophets communicated by every possible means. And they not only communicated with their words, they communicated with their actions. They had little one-act plays or dramas. My pronunciation is probably different from yours, but I hope you know what I'm talking about. Little dramatic actions. And some of these were R-rated. So Jeremiah hid his underwear in the rock until it went rotten. And Isaiah went naked and barefoot for 3.5 years. And Ezekiel did some funny things. He cut off his hair and blew it out the window and that sort of thing. So he is. These are symbolic actions where he's symbolizing. For example, he's told to draw a diagram of the siege of Jerusalem on a brick. And then he has an iron fry pan to show that the prayers of the people will not get through to God. No matter how much they pray, he's not going to deliver them this time. So the exile is symbolized. Fifthly, in chapters 25 to 32, we have the oracles concerning the foreign nations. So Yahweh is not only the God of Israel, he's the God of the whole world, and all of the nations are accountable to him. And he has judgments that will deal with each one of the foreign nations, and he will actually not only bring judgment against each one of them, but invite them to find deliverance among God's people in Israel. Then in chapters 33, the good news starts. There's 32 chapters of bad news, and finally we get to some of the good news. Judgment is not the last word in the Old Testament. Restoration is the last word, and God says, I will restore. I will bring you back. And so we see how God deals in chapters 33 to 36. We see God will give leadership that is much better than the leadership they have been given through the Davidic kings, and he will restore them. Then we have in chapters 37 to 39 the two visions where God restores his people. One is the Valley of Dry Bones. You probably know that one, where all of the bones start coming together and then they get sinews and muscles on them and finally flesh and skin. And what's happening here is resurrection is a metaphor for return from exile. God is going to bring them back from exile. And then in chapters 38 and 39, we see them living peaceably in the land until the enemies of God attack them at the end of history. Finally, we see a utopian vision in chapters 40 to 48, a vision of the city, of the temple, of the land. It's a wonderful vision of God dwelling once more in the midst of his people as king. And John, in the book of Revelation, shows us that this is really talking about the new heavens and the new earth, where the God's people come down out of heaven after God makes a new heavens and a new earth, and they live with God in the new heavens and the new earth. That may not be your interpretation, but it is the interpretation of the Apostle John. Yeah. We can talk about this. As already noted, the opening vision portrays the glory of the Lord in motion because God is getting ready to move out. The second section presents Ezekiel's message and role. Like all the prophets, he employs every means and method of communication to get through to the people because of idolatry in relation to God and social injustice in relation to others because they have broken the covenant and the curse of exile is upon them. So I talked about that. Another example of one of these dramatic actions is in chapter 4, he's commanded to lie on one side for 390 days for the sins of Israel, and on the other side for 40 days for the sins of Judah. So what happens when we add 390 and 40? Anyone does mathematics here? 430. Now, if you think about the history of Israel, what does 430 represent? It represents the time they were in Egypt. And so what's happening in these prophetic books is the prophets are using they're using images from God's great act of deliverance in the past to picture a future and coming deliverance. And one of the things, so for example, all throughout the book of Isaiah, he portrays the coming deliverance, the coming salvation, as a new exodus, as a bigger exodus, much bigger and better and greater than the first exodus. We see statements in the book of Isaiah, they're also in the book of Jeremiah. Let's just look at one while we're here. I think, if I'm not mistaken, let's try the one in I'm actually thinking of Jeremiah 16. Let's see here. Jeremiah 6, this is an example from Jeremiah. Jeremiah 16, verse 14. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it shall no longer be said, as the Lord lives, who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives, who brought the people of Israel up out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them. So he's saying, in the future, you're not going to boast about the Exodus. You're going to boast about something bigger and better, God delivering you from Babylon. Now, if you know, if you've looked at a map, you will see that Babylon is not in the north of Israel. Babylon is in the east. But between Babylon and Israel is a big desert. Some of you people know what that is. In the ancient world, the scary word was not the C word, it was the D word. D stands for desert, and desert means death. And so the only way to get from Babylon to Israel is to go up to follow the Euphrates River to the north and come down from the north. So even though Babylon is in the east, the enemies come from the north. So what he's saying is, you're not going to be boasting about God delivering you from Egypt. You're going to be boasting about God delivering you from Babylon. And Isaiah shows that the deliverance involves two stages. It involves physical deliverance from Babylon, bringing the people out of Babylon, and then spiritual deliverance, fixing the broken relationship. This is what Daniel's talking about in Daniel chapter 9. Daniel says, I've read the book of Jeremiah. Hurry up, God. 70 years is over. Let's get back. And God says, well, you can bring the people out of Babylon, but how do you get Babylon out of the people? That will take a lot longer than 70 years. That'll take 77s. Now, look at what Jeremiah says right here. I will bring them back to their own land that I gave their fathers. Now, what he does here is, first of all, in verses 14 and 15, he speaks in plain speech, and then in verse 16, he speaks in figures of speech. Behold, I am sending for many fishermen, declares the Lord, and they shall catch them. And afterward, I will send many hunters, and they will hunt them. So he's saying the same thing. I'm going to bring the exiles home. And of course, you remember that this is what Jesus told his disciples. Remember that? Jesus said to his disciples, I will make you fishers of men. Well, if you know your Old Testament, what he's saying is, I'm sending you guys to bring the exiles home, to bring them back and fix that broken relationship between me and the people. All right, what happened to what I was doing here? Unfortunately, the people did not heed Ezekiel's message. According to Ezekiel 33, verse 32, the prophet was viewed only as an entertainer singing songs with a beautiful voice. Chapters 8 to 11 constitute a second vision in which the glory of the Lord departs from the temple. This is followed by further messages to Judah, largely using symbolic dramas to communicate the coming judgment and exile. As I said, 25 to 32 are oracles concerning the foreign nations. Such oracles are included in all the major prophets because of the program laid out in Deuteronomy 32. The covenant violation of Israel will bring the curse of exile. At first, God plans to completely erase his people, but he is afraid of the taunts of foreign nations. The foreign nations will come to the wrong conclusion. They will conclude it's their might, their power, their technology, their military hardware that allowed them to conquer Israel. And that's a lie. The only reason that Israel was conquered is because they were unfaithful to their God. So God has to deal with the nations and show them who is in charge of this world. The nations must be punished for their arrogance and idolatrous worldview, for their harsh treatment of the people of God. Then in chapters 33 to 36, Israel will be given new leadership in the form of a new David, the Messiah. Stephen Dempster says, even the divided kingdom of exiles is reunited under a new leader who is said to be my servant David, but he is also described as one who will come to power through relative obscurity. In a remarkable allegorical passage, a Davidic descendant is compared to a tender shoot plucked from a tall tree, taken to Mount Zion, and planted there to grow into a huge tree, bearing fruit and providing shade for all the birds of the forest. Thus all the trees of the forest, that is, the peoples of the world, will know that I, the Lord, lower the tall tree and raise the low tree. I dry up the green tree and make the dry tree flourish. He's not talking about trees. He's talking about people. It's an allegory. Later, this David who will come to power is remembered for his humble origins as a shepherd. He will provide true leadership as opposed to past leaders who are symbolized as corrupt and destructive shepherds. These kind of leaders are still with us today, by the way. Both these motifs of Davidic rule, a tender shoot and a shepherd, echo Jeremiah's prediction of plant growth from the line of David, which will bring the good shepherds justice for the nation. Then there will be a new covenant to renew the relationship between God and his people that will deal effectively with hearts stubbornly bent on sin, Ezekiel 36, 24 to 32. This is followed by an announcement of return from exile, described in terms of resurrection from the dead. The vision of the Valley of Dry Bones shows the people of God miraculously restored to life and given a victory over enemies. The book concludes in chapters 40 to 48 with a vision of a renewed temple and God dwelling in the midst of his people. So the shock of the book of Ezekiel is that it ends with the phrase, Yahweh is there. The Lord is there. So we see at the beginning of the book, God's throne has wheels because he's getting ready to move out. We see him move out in chapters 8 through 11. We see his people go into exile. But that's not the end of the story. God restores his people. He brings them back. He fixes the broken relationship. And in the end, he comes back because it's now a 10-star hotel. And it's a place where he wants to live with his people. The glory, God is once more dwelling in the midst of his people. Thus, restoration involves rebuilding the Davidic house in both its meanings in 2 Samuel 7. So in 2 Samuel 7, there's a play on words because building the house means building the family line of David and building the temple. And God is going to fix both of those problems. He's going to restore the family line of David, which he's already done, because Jesus is a descendant of David, and through his resurrection, he's living forever. And he's actually rebuilding the temple right now. We'll talk about that. So we can spend... when does this end, Andy? Dr. McClure? 10:15. So I'm going to talk briefly about it, and then we can... if you have questions, you may have questions, you can ask questions. So in we have this vision of the city and the temple and the land. We could divide it into three parts. In 40 to 43, Yahweh establishes his residence in the temple, and what you see in chapter he describes this temple, and then in chapter 43. The glory cloud returns. It's as if it's interesting, he doesn't wait till the end. He doesn't wait till the end to return. God is like the father in the prodigal son. He's in a hurry to be back with his child. And then in 44 to 46, we see Israel's response to his presence in their midst. So there's a description of an appropriate forms of worship. And I would suggest that Ezekiel is describing the future using the language of the past. And then in 47 and 48, the land is divided up to the restored Israel, which, by the way, includes Gentiles. Gentiles are living in the midst of Israel, and they're actually allowed to possess land, which is not allowed for Gentiles in the Torah, in the Pentateuch. So this restored Israel includes both Jew and Gentile. And then in 47, and then we see there's a special area in the middle for the temple and the worship of God. And there's not only a temple there, but there's a city there. And all of these things, the city, even though the city, the temple, and the land are separate in the vision, they're all talking about the same thing, because that's how John interprets it in Revelation 21. So let's talk about this. How to interpret the final section of Ezekiel has been hotly debated among Christians. It may even be debated hotly here, who knows? Some think that this is a blueprint for a future temple to be built in the city of Jerusalem. I do not think such an interpretation is likely. Space permits only a couple of observations. First, notice that this section is described as visions of God. So in Ezekiel 40, verse 2, he says, "I saw in visions of God." This exact phrase only occurs two other places. It occurs in Ezekiel 1, where he has this vision of the throne of God. And we also see it in chapters 8 through 11. And so how would we interpret the vision in chapters 1 to 3? Well, we would see that as a symbolic vision. He's the fact that the throne has all these wheels is symbolic of the fact that God is getting ready to move out. We see the same thing in chapter 8 through 11. So why should we use a different approach to interpret this passage when it's described exactly the same way? Second, there's a lot of detailed description here using the words length and width. So I did something that was rather boring. I got out a concordance and I looked up every occurrence of the words length, width, and height in the Old Testament. And I found something rather interesting. 80% of these three words occur in three passages. Exodus 25 to 40, where they're building the tabernacle. 1 Kings 6 through 8, where they're building the temple. And Ezekiel 40 to 48. But there is one crucial difference. In Exodus 25 to 40, you have length, height, and width. In the building of the temple, you have length, height, and width. In this passage, there's length and width, but no height. Why is there no height? Because it's not a blueprint for a real building. If it was a blueprint for a real building, it would have length, height, and width. So the tabernacle was a plan that God showed Moses on the mountain for that they were supposed to build, and it had length, height, and width. The temple was something that they were supposed to build. The tabernacle, the temple in Ezekiel's vision is not something they're supposed to build. It's something that's already built. He sees it built, and he's supposed to go and tell the people of Israel what he sees. So when we come to the New Testament, we see that this is the interpretation of Jesus. So, for example, Jesus was looking at the temple in Jerusalem that was built by Herod the Great, and he said, "You see these great stones?" He said, "Destroy this temple and I will rebuild it in 3 days." And they didn't know what he was talking about until after the resurrection. He wasn't talking about building the physical stones. Jesus himself is the temple. And the apostles understood that. Paul calls the church in Corinth the temple. Peter says, you are living stones being built into a spiritual dwelling place for God. So the rebuilding of the temple is the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the people in the church. And as you know, if a person dies, their body goes into the ground, their spirit goes to heaven to be with the Lord. And when Jesus comes again, those who are on the earth will be caught up to meet him in the air, and then the new Jerusalem, the people of God, will come down out of heaven and live on the earth. So I think it's very important to follow Jesus and the apostles in their interpretation of the Old Testament. We can also, I'll just spend a couple more minutes on this. Get rid of this. There we go. One of the things that's important when we're reading the Bible is we have to figure out what kind of literature we're reading. So many of you may not even know what a newspaper is anymore. But if you have a big newspaper, it has many different sections. So it has the front page news, and then there's a business section, there's leisure and travel, there's real estate, there's stocks and bonds, there's the comics, and there's the obituaries. My wife likes to read the obituaries. These are all different kinds of literature. And we don't read these kinds of literature in the same way. So, for example, could we say that there's truth on the front page news and no truth in the comics? Could we say that? There might be more truth in the comics than there is on the front page. The point is, it's a different kind of literature, and it has different rules for reading it. And when you turn the page, you don't even think about that. You don't think, oh, I must remember the rules for reading the comics. Okay? And so that's very important. This wasn't explained to me when I went to seminary. It's taken me 40 years to learn this. So when I went to seminary, we had a book on how to interpret the scriptures. And what this book said, well, when you go back to the church fathers, there are some church fathers that allegorize everything, and other church fathers are literal. So obviously we don't want to allegorize everything. We want to have a literal interpretation. But they never explained to me that there were different kinds of literature in the Bible, and you don't read the comics the same way you read the front page news. So you can't read the book of Revelation the way you read Romans, because books like Ezekiel and Daniel and Zechariah and Revelation are much more like the comics than reading something like Romans. How do we know that? Well, first of all, think about the book. Let's go back and think about the book of Ezekiel. What do we notice? First of all, we notice these symbolic visions. Chapter 1 to 3, where he sees the glory of God. Chapter 8 through 11, where he sees the glory of God. What else do we notice? We notice symbolic actions. So I made a list of all these things. Here. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3, the drama of the brick and the fry pan. Chapter 4, verses 4 to 8, the drama of lying on his side for 390 or 440 days and nights. Chapter 4, verses 9 to 17, the drama of the diet during the siege of Jerusalem. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 4, the drama of shaving his hair. 12, 1 to 16, the drama of the exile's baggage. So he's supposed to sit there with a suitcase to warn people, you know, get ready to go. Chapter 12, 7 to 20, the drama of anxious eating. So the book, unlike other Unlike other books, it's filled with these symbolic dramas. Then there are tons of allegories. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 8, the allegory of the useless vine. Chapter 16, 1 to 63, the allegory of the young woman and her sisters. It's an R-rated story, but it's in the Bible. 17, 1 to 24, an allegory of two eagles and a vine. 23, 1 to 49, the allegory of two adulterous sisters, Ohola and Oholibah. Chapter 24, the parable of the cooking pot. Chapter 24, the debt, even the death of Ezekiel's wife is a symbolic act. Chapter 31, the allegory of Assyria as a big tree, a cedar growing in Lebanon. So how do you, when you're reading Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, how do you know that it's an allegory? Well, he gives you hints, doesn't he? He gives you hints on how to read what he's telling you, hints on how to interpret it. So you can see from the book of Ezekiel how many hints we have on how to read this book. So why should we do something totally different at the end of the book? We also know that it's symbolic because the dimensions that are given are not practical. I'll give you an example of this. One is chapter 42. Chapter 42, verse 15. And I'm reading from the ESV, the English Standard Version. Now, when he had finished measuring the interior of the temple area, he led me out by the gate that faced east and measured the temple area all around. So he's now going to talk about, he's measuring the exterior. These are the exterior dimensions, not the interior dimensions. He measured the east side with a measuring reed or rod, 500 cubits by the measuring reed all around. He measured the north side, 500 cubits by the measuring reed all round. He measured the south side, 500 cubits by the measuring reed. He turned to the west side and measured 500 cubits by the measuring reed. He measured it on the four sides. It had a wall all around it, 500 cubits long and 500 cubits broad, to make a separation between the holy and the common. Now, I'm sorry to tell you this, but the word cubit isn't in the Hebrew text. The word in the Hebrew text is rods. And he tells you in chapter 40, verse 3, or is it 3 or 5? Chapter 40, verse 3 or 5, and also in chapter 43, that a rod is 6 cubits, and each cubit is a cubit and a handbreadth. So just so that you can figure out how this works, this is the system of measurement in the ancient Near East. So a cubit is from your elbow to your fingertips. If you can spread your fingers like this, this is called a span. A cubit is two spans. See, it probably works on your arm and the way it works on mine. And four fingers together is called a handbreadth, and there are six handbreadths in a cubit. Some cubits had seven and some cubits had five, but the ones in Israel. But what happened in Israel was inflation. Do you know what inflation is? So when they went down to the store to buy something had happened to the yardstick. It had shrunk. And so he says, we're going back to the old measurement, a cubit. Each cubit is a cubit and a handbreadth. Okay, so that means that this measuring rod is about, I don't really know what it is, 6 times 20 inches, 6 times, let's say, 21 inches divided by 12, it's about 9 or 10 feet, this measuring rod. So the area outside the temple is 52 miles by 52 miles. That doesn't even fit into the country of Israel as we know it. So he's telling you something that's not practical, Why is he telling you that? Because if you read the book of Ezekiel, you'll see that the kings started building their tombs right in the temple area. And God says, I don't want any of that junk happening. I want a big space between the worship of me and your other stuff. So he's giving you a mental picture. He's giving you a mental picture of what it means to really be totally devoted to the Lord and totally focused on the Lord, you know, not with all of the... Do we worship the Lord by, you know, with all of the distractions or our iPhone, or are we really giving him space? That's what he's trying to tell you. So, and there's a river that comes out of the middle of the temple, so that's not something that happens in normal life. And this river grows without any tributaries in volume and size more than any river that we know of on the face of the earth. So it's not something that's, it's something, it's probably something that's symbolic. So there's a lot of indications throughout the thing that he wants us to interpret the text this way. It's a beautiful vision of future life with God in the new heavens and the new earth. At least that's, I think, how John interprets it. Any questions? Yeah, go ahead. Yes, and I think that goes back to what I said about Deuteronomy 32. So if you don't understand Deuteronomy 32, you won't understand the rest of the Old Testament. What Moses took the whole Pentateuch and he digested it into a single song, because even the teenagers can get that. And in that song, he shows that Israel is going to be unfaithful. They're going to break the covenant relationship. God is going to be faithful to his threats. He's going to send them into the exile. But that isn't the end. Two things have to happen. God has to restore the broken relationship between himself and his people. And he has to show the nations that Israel wasn't captured by their might and their power, but because of her covenant unfaithfulness. And so this is a theme all the way through the book of Ezekiel, that Israel's idolatry and her social injustice, failing to love your neighbor as yourself, is violating the name of Yahweh and his reputation in the world. And once this wonderful restoration takes place, people will be able to see what God's character is like by looking at his people. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, that does. That helps.
And I think you have to connect it to those verses in Ezekiel where he's talking about how Israel defiled the name of Yahweh. The whole world will know. The whole world will know what it means to be utterly devoted and faithful in a relationship, and what that means. This may be the only time in the next 50 years that this book will be talked about. All right.